Hello, friends. It's today a privilege and a pleasure to have someone of the eminence of Professor Radhika Desai join us in this colloquium. Professor Desai will speak on a thing which is already on the screen, Hindutva as a cultural nationalism, Indian origins of a paradigm. She will discuss how the Indian experience of cultural nationalism has become the basis for an innovative, new theoretical perspective on nationalism in our time. So going from the specific to the general. She will examine the Indian case from a comparative perspective and explore the implications for conceptions of citizenship. And that last bit was, I think it's good news to you, that was a clever twist. Why? I'll explain in a minute. Professor Desai is a professor at the Department of Political Studies in the University of Manitoba, Winnipeg, and is currently a research fellow in residence at the Zentrum Moderner Orient, Berlin. She is the author, we had a conversation earlier, and Radhika warned me about her fanciful titles. So, prepare yourself for this one. She is the author of Slouching Towards Ayodhya. Now you know where that metaphor comes from. From Congress to Hindutva in Indian Politics, and Intellectuals and Socialism, Social Democrats and the Labour Party, that's the 1994 publication, and she is the editor of Development and Cultural Nationalism, which was a special issue of the Third World Quarterly. And she has numerous articles in various journals, including the Economic and Political Weekly, Third World Quarterly. And believe it or not, she is capable of writing two books at the same time. Now,
or condemned to.
On different things. They are another fanciful title. When was globalization? When was globalization? Origin and end of a US strategy. And the second one is the making of the Indian capitalist class. Professor Desai will speak for 45 minutes or so, and then she will take questions and have a general conversation. But before she does that, allow me a couple of minutes to introduce the audience to you. This is a joint audience. Part of it is my colloquium, and part of it is the Excellence Cluster. My colloquium struggles with theoretical ways of understanding Indian politics. Long ago, I had struggled with it myself, and I've written a piece called Fraud Paradigms, Western Models of Indian Politics, which then became Culture and Nationality. And we have a very broad group of political scientists here, some working on political science as a search for verifiable laws, and others working entirely on the hermeneutic of politics and social phenomena. You can see the very broad spectrum. And your topic, which has its ontological angle but also comparative stretch, would nicely fit into the agenda of the colloquium on our PhD program here. The reason we have smuggled in citizenship was for a completely different reason. Well, the colloquium has intellect, but for the other ways of bringing important visitors here, for the money, we look at the Excellence Project. Now, the Excellence Project has given us a grant to work on citizenship. Now, anything that has to do with citizenship, therefore, is a part of our agenda too. But how do we go about it? Here, we have broken away from our political science sectarianism, and we are looking at it in terms of a larger methodology which underpins the Excellence Cluster. It is about conceptual flow, about how the self understands the self, sometimes with the categories of the other, and sometimes in a way which undermines the self. We had Ashish Nandi here, and he talked about the intimate enemy and the conceptual flow. Except that the cluster beliefs is not any longer a unidirectional flow of Europe making a home for itself outside Europe and getting non-Europeans to understand themselves and undermine themselves in European categories. Is there a counterflow? Are there ways of being citizens which are not ways one has learned from the master, but which are indigenous? Could I stand up and say, I am a citizen because I had buried or burnt my ancestors on this soil, which has become part of mine, and what I believe I'll die for or kill for? Is that enough to become a citizen, or do you have to have a recognition from the modern legal rational state to be a citizen? Or is it an interplay of the two? As you can see, within this project, we are asking questions which are general to the whole excellence cluster. I only hope you enjoy the conversation here and will come back for more. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Professor Mitra. What you said has actually made the whole exercise of giving this presentation even more, it has energized me even more to do that, because I think that I see parallels here which are not necessarily always agreements, but also tensions in, you know, some of the things you said, and I hope that I'm looking forward to a real engagement with this audience. But first of all, let me just do a couple of other thank yous. Thank you also to Jiva, who has been absolutely fantastic in terms of looking after me and my sort of various arrangements and so on. So it's been completely smooth, the whole trip, and I've also enjoyed briefly talking with her, and looking forward to some more. And also thanks to Professor Rothman for taking part in the initiative to invite me here. And I must also say that it's a great honor for me to speak at the South Asia Institute. I had, of course, heard always about it. And I always thought it was a very illustrious organization, but at the same time, it wasn't until I got here that I realized it has an entire multi-story building to itself. And I was very impressed with this, and a very grand library. And I know that it has been, and I have benefited from many researches that have already taken place here, and I hope to do more. So this is a great honor for me. In many ways, the project that I want to say a few things before I begin my presentation, partly inspired by some of the things that I have just heard. The project that I am about to talk about really began, in part at least, because of my frustration with a lot of the most interesting India studies. I mean, in many ways, there are, or let me put it this way, there's a very powerful tendency in the study of India to consider it sui generis. Somehow India is always different, whether you are looking at it from a cultural or political or any other point of view. And of course, it's always paradoxical and so on. And I really have always wanted to, and in fact, a bulk of my work on India has attempted to do this in a variety of ways, whether it's my understanding of India's political economy, which is of course easier, but also Hindutva and things like that. I refuse to treat India as sui generis. I always insist on trying to put it within a comparative perspective. So in many ways, this project is one of the more developed results of that endeavor. Basically, in the late 1990s, I was invited to take part in a large workshop on Asia, and I was asked to say something about nationalism, and I readily accepted because I had been thinking about this. While the rest of the world was talking about how globalization has undermined nation states, being from India, I was confronted with a very different problem. And that was that if you, and studying India, I don't live in India anymore, so I don't want to give you the wrong impression, nor do I assume any kind of essentialist connection with it. I spent my first 20 years of my life there, and I go back there very often, but that's that. But nevertheless, studying India and being concerned about it gave me a very different problematic, which was how had the Indian nationalism of the early decades of after independence become converted into Hindu nationalism? What were the dynamics of that development? What had caused it? What has created the transition? What was its political economy, its sociology, its whatever, all of these things, and how exactly were the two different? So I was trying to understand that, and I wrote that paper, and then eventually, because of coming together of many other forces, which I won't bore you with, but when I went, one of them was that when I went to Victoria, I began to work with a lot of other Asianists. So I wanted to, in the end, create a kind of comparative project, and because so many of my colleagues there were Asianists, we decided to make it, for the moment at least, an Asian comparative project. And I basically proposed that we should try and see whether this kind of transition in nationalism could be observed elsewhere. So in a sense, it's very much a comparative project, but it is also very rooted in a very Indian experience. The project took place over 3 years. We had two very, very interesting workshops involving a couple of dozen scholars on different parts of Asia, including the Middle East. And the results have just been published as a special issue of Third World Quarterly, and Routledge is bringing it out as an edited collection, I believe, just in about 2 weeks' time. So what I've done now is I'm going to try and summarize this project for you. Exactly what is the larger problematic that it's attempting to deal with, and how does it relate to India? And I will attempt to relate it to citizenship. And there I would like to say two or three more things. I tend not to invest too much into this dialectic of master-slave and, you know, somehow all of the, you know, which tends to equate the formal institutions of democracy in India with Western institutions. To me, formal institutions of democracy are just the formal casing. And then you have within, and they are usually, they have broad similarities across cultures. What you then have are different notions of nationhood, which give a very different content to the experience of citizenship. And that's what I want to talk about. And indeed, what I'm also saying is that this experience of citizenship is not merely national. It is also historical, because within a single country, that can change. The experience of citizenship, say, for example, in the UK, to take a completely different country, say, at a time when the welfare state was being created, when T.H. Marshall was talking about adding to political citizenship, economic citizenship, and social citizenship, was very different from the kind of citizenship in which, under the governments of Mrs. Thatcher and Tony Blair, people are being invited to think of themselves not as citizens, but as customers. This is a very, it's a customers of the state. This is a very, very different experience. And so I want to sort of create a cross-contextual reflection. And I would generally, I mean, I would hold to this, that I because you see, if you really want to break out of Orientalism, then you have to reject the master-slave dialectic altogether. You have to say that there are different countries and you have to compare them. It is not a question of master or slave. And of course, as you probably are also aware, a lot of the more recent Indian historiography, I'm thinking particularly of the work of people like Chris Bailey, has actually emphasized the extent to which even in colonial India, Indian actors were as important in the making of what was colonial India as were the colonial masters. And although I don't particularly like quoting Gandhi that much, he asked a very reasonable question. How can it be that a few thousand British people can rule India? Well, the answer was they didn't. Indians also ruled themselves in particular ways during colonial times. But anyway, that's just a broader reflection. So I just want to say, let's get comparative. Okay, so this is my attempt. And not just my attempt, but the attempt of where we started with a couple of dozen different collaborators. And I wish I brought, if anyone wants to know, I can rattle off the names. There were some quite wonderful people who were involved. Not everybody could contribute, but we ended up with a dozen really solid contributions and a very substantial introduction from me, laying out the broad problematic, answering some larger questions, and then also a very substantial conclusion in which I drew together the common agreements and tensions generated by this project. That's what I want to talk to you about. And so let me get on with it without too many further preliminaries. So I want to begin by saying a few things about how actually, when I began to approach this topic, I realized that the study of nationalism suffers from very peculiar forms of neglect. So for example, in the 19th century, and across the political spectrum, people tended to be focused on universalist logics, whether it was the march of universal reason or the spread of the market. So for example, I'm just here, I have a little quote from a very fine piece by Perry Anderson on the ends of history, which was written partly as a reflection on Fukuyama's book, but in which he makes a very interesting set of reflections about Hegel, and in which he says that for Hegel's Sittlichkeit, he says the national character of Sittlichkeit was curiously vestigial. It didn't really have a kind of full presence. The variety of national states is structurally underdetermined in Hegel's vision of the modern world because there's only room for one truly rational version at a time. So you have a succession of, this is a Anderson's remark. But and then you have, on the other hand, one of the most famous texts from this century, the Communist Manifesto, 1848, Marx and Engels, what are they trying to imagine? They have this, and I'm sorry to present this to you all, this audience in English, but I wish I'd thought enough to go to the German text and bring this out. But basically, this idea of the bourgeoisie effectively being the agent of a spread, of the creation of a single unified world economy, many people regard it as a kind of vortex of globalization. And what do they say? The bourgeoisie, by the rapid improvement of all instruments of production, by the immensely facilitated means of communication, and remember that was only the age of telegraphs and shipping and so on, draws all, even the most barbarian nations into civilization. The cheap price of its commodities, and remember this analogy because we'll come back to it later, the cheap price of its commodities are the heavy artillery with which it batters down all Chinese walls, with which it forces the barbarians' intensely obstinate hatred of foreigners to capitulate. It compels all nations, on pain of extinction, to adopt the bourgeois mode of production. It compels them to introduce what it calls civilization into their midst, i.e. to become bourgeois themselves. In a word, it creates a world after its own image. So the idea you have is that there is a kind of world economy and nations, if they exist, are somehow just incidental to it. They're sort of walls or boundaries due to be eroded by the workings of the market. You go a little bit onwards, of course, and during the latter part of the 19th century and the early 20th century, of course, you have the big emergence of inter-imperialist competition leading up to the First World War. But by the end of the First World War, you have the beginnings of some really interesting understanding and analysis of nations and nationalism, and Wilson and Lenin are competing with each other. And I, by the way, highly recommend a very fine historical work by Arno Meyer called Wilson versus Lenin, The Political Origins of Modern Diplomacy. Wilson and Lenin competing with each other briefly to offer the rest of the world self-determination, but of course this becomes very quickly overtaken by the continuing strength of imperialist tendencies. But this is also the time, the interwar period, when Gramsci produces his extremely interesting reflections on the national popular. Okay, but again, these things tend not to be, I mean, on the whole, when people are trying to understand the world and the shape of the world, they tend to focus on the fact that there's a world economy, and if they focus on geopolitics at all, they tend to focus on imperialism and empires. Of course, in the early 20th century, nations were also revived because nationalism was seen to have made a major contribution to the emergence of fascism. And so as a consequence, you know, nationalism was not a very good thing, perhaps, to talk about, to valorize, to think, you know, it wasn't such a good thing. And of course, in the latter part of the 20th century, when thanks to decolonization, the nation-state system spread to the world practically as a whole, not quite, but they tended to be underestimated, because within a couple of decades it was already very clear that compared to the hopes invested in these new nations, their actual performance had been disappointing. So people tended to emphasize the extent to which these nations and their independence had made no difference. We still lived in a world of neo-colonialism, if not colonialism outright, and so on and so forth. Now, in the 1980s, you had a fair renaissance. Oh, I've forgotten my... Did anyone bring my bag here? No, we don't. If you don't mind, yeah. Okay, so in the 1980s, you had a renaissance of a writing on nationalism, and there was quite a lot of writing. A number of major intellectuals produced works. However, there were two quite important problems with this. One is that insofar as it became anything bigger than its major works, like Eric Hobsbawm or Benedict Anderson or whoever, it tended to be predominantly a cultural study. And what's more, it was dominated by one work, and that was Benedict Anderson's work, Imagined Communities. And I consider that a deeply flawed work, and part of the reason I troubled Jiva to get the bag is that I brought along some copies of a review I did of Anderson's Imagined Communities when it was republished as a major new edition in 2006, because it was just about the time I was working on this project, and I reread this book. I was asked actually to do a review of it, and I thought, all right, I'll do it. It's a good time to read this major work. And I sat down and I read it, and it suddenly crystallized for me all the things that had been wrong with this. And so I wrote up a review, which I brought some copies of for those of you who are particularly interested in Anderson, have been influenced by it, you might find it interesting. But Imagined Communities retain the overwhelmingly cultural emphasis in terms of understanding nations. And of course, the postmodernist currents around them at the time tended to reinforce that. And so as a consequence, an overwhelmingly cultural study of nationalism was easily overwhelmed when globalization, economistic globalization rhetoric came along and started saying, well, nations have become irrelevant. So you have, for example, here, I just have two statements by Anderson that are remarkably opposite, and Anderson never comments on this. So in 1989-90, whenever the second edition of his book came out, and I'm quoting him, he said, the end of the era of nationalism, and he's referring here to Hobsbawm's work of that roughly the same time, he says, so long prophesied is not remotely in sight. Indeed, nationness is the most universally legitimate value in the political life of our time. And in 1996, by the time he has been hit by the waves of globalization discourse, completely new rhetoric. Globalization has made the future of nation states unsure. The new nations of the 1990s, that is the one that came into being after the Soviet Union collapsed, were unlikely to disturb global trends, which portended the impending crisis of the hyphen that for 200 years yoked together state and nation. Portable nationality, read under the sign of identity, is on the rapid rise as people everywhere are on the move. So the idea is that 200 years, nation states were the mainstay of defining the world order of capitalism. Suddenly, poof, they're gone. Globalization, in a few short years, has made their existence unnecessary. And of course, globalization merely said that nation states were unnecessary. Empire literature began to portray them as a positive danger. So you had failed states and rogue states that had to be disciplined and brought to... And remember, all of this discourse is primarily about third world states. This is, has nothing to do on the whole. Nobody is going to say that, you know, Germany or Iceland have become failed states or anything. In reality, and here is my view of nations and nationalism, is that I believe that there is a dialectic of the universal and the particular. Yes, indeed, capitalism is a form of society which has certain universalizing, objective universalizing tendencies. There is an objective universalism to capitalism which does create, whether it goes to Iceland or to Malawi, very, very similar sets of processes, conditions, and so on. Thank you so much. So I just put these there, or maybe circulate them, anybody wants them. And actually, there are some flyers as well, so maybe you can circulate them together. So there is an objective universalism to capitalism. However, at the same time, there is a process which creates, as part of this universality, a series of discrete and particular nation states. What is this process is what we have to understand. So the way I look at it, rather than being opposed to each other, capitalism and the nation state, class and nation, the universalism of the law of value or markets, whatever, however you think about it, and the particularity of the various ways in which its inexorable operation has been dammed and channeled by national political economies remains central to the understanding of the evolution of the capitalist world order. You cannot understand it in any other way. And Professor Mitra mentioned my work on globalization, and this is one of the fundamental theoretical problems that I'm trying to unravel in this book as well. So nations are just as real, and we'll talk about that in a minute as well. So I began, now I just want to sort of detach from that and go to the Indian preoccupations with which I entered. Certainly growing up in India, I most people of my generation at least, perhaps I was one of the last ones, but could not but be impressed by the fact that economic nationalism had been central to Indian nationalism. You could not talk about Indian nationalism without thinking about Dadabhai Nauroji, R.C. Dutt, and all the others who did not say to the British, "You are killing our national soul." They said, "You are basically destroying our economy." Right? It was not about the national soul at all. It was not about cultural domination. It was about economic domination, plain and simple. Early Indian nationalism, particularly once large numbers of people began to be mobilized under the banner of Indian nationalism, had to put a big stress on development. Even the Indian capitalist class understood that. That's why they came up with the Bombay Plan. So there always was the emphasis on development. And I'd also like to stress that despite the fact that we are disappointed by, and I think rightly so, we are disappointed by the development record of most nations, and we should be disappointed because it could be a lot better and it has not been particularly good. But it is also important to bear in mind that it has achieved certain things. And here, I just want to, this is a very long and complex quote from one of Deepak Nair's articles, but if you read it, it really stresses for me what a big break in India's history the end of colonialism was. So he says there are two sets of growth rates for the period 1900 to 1901 to 46-47, two different estimates. One estimate suggests that in real terms, growth in national income was 1% per annum during this time, and per capita income, 0.2% per annum. Another one puts it down to 0.8% and 0.04% per annum. And then he goes on to say, the growth rates for the period 50-51 to 2004-2005 provide a sharp contrast. In real terms, growth in GDP was 4.2% per annum, while growth in per capita income was 2.1% per annum. And remember, third world countries have always been beaten with the stick of per capita income. And it is true, I mean, third world countries need to be more prosperous in per capita terms. But also we have to remember that the fact that this represented an expansion of population was itself an achievement. When India became independent, the ordinary life expectancy of people was about 30 years. It is only about 60-something right now. That's abysmal. It should be much better. In Kerala, for example, it's much better, even though Kerala is one of the poorest states in the country. So my point is that let's not forget that the expansion of population was itself something of a material achievement, and I think it should not be forgotten. However, this nationalism has been followed by a very different nationalism, Hindu nationalism. And that's what I've been trying to understand. There was a very sense of a very, very sharp break in 1992 after the destruction of the Babri Masjid. I still remember, I mean, I wasn't in India at the time, I have no fancy story to tell you, and in fact the story I have to tell you about that is shows how distant I was from it, but also at the same time how much I was trying to understand. And I listened to it would have been probably a month or so later, a program that the CBC did, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation did, the radio station, on what had happened in India. And I still remember Romila Thapa, who most of you will recognize as one of the most prominent historians of India, who has been attempting to contest the interpretations of Indian history being given by the Hindu nationalists. I mean, her voice absolutely quavering, coming across the radio waves, and basically saying, you know, something very fundamental has been broken in this country. A Rubicon has been crossed, and we don't know what is going to happen at this point. There was a very, very profound sense that something really, really horrible and terrible had happened, and I'm not sure that this was sense was necessarily wrong. And of course, here's my attempt to relate all of this to formal citizenship. Because what nationalism does, you can have the formal structure of citizenship. The formal structure of citizenship can give you X, Y, and Z rights. But the particular context in which you exercise it is governed by the cultural context created by nationalism. And the nationalism is not merely a cultural context. It comes with a specific political economy, a specific form of society, and so on. So what nationalism typically have tended to do is they create order within a kind of cultural ordering of more or less unequal societies. They adapt old orders of precedence to new orders of precedence. So, for example, what do the pre-capitalist or pre-modern orders of precedence have to do with the present order of precedence? And you'll see that they can be very different ways of doing that. It unites and reorders regional and other types of differences. And it operates ideologically as well as through state structures. So it operates through formal structures as well as through informal structures of what we may call civil society. In a sense, it basically gives form, content to the formal structures of nationalism. So if we look at Indian and Hindu nationalism, we can contrast them at least in these ways. And these will not be very unfamiliar to you. So Indian nationalism was developmental, secular. It focused on material gains. It offered people material gains. It was inclusive, or at least attempted to be so. I'm not saying that this is all, you know, but that this was the trend within it. It was popular, and it was egalitarian, and best of all, these are part of my fanciful titles, it promised us a better tomorrow. But Hindu nationalism is neoliberal. It is communal or religious. It does not offer you material gains, but perhaps, if at all, a share, greater or lesser, depending on your position in society, of cultural glory. It's exclusive. It's elitist. It's inegalitarian. And at best, it promises you a better yesterday. So, this is what Hindu nationalism is. So, this was the idea, but I thought, well, does it have legs? Is it going to travel any further than India? Right? Will it go very far? I mean, this may be just another way of understanding India. But prima facie, it did, because it wasn't as though Japan had its Nihon Jinron and there was a surge in thinking about Asian values and Confucian values. And in Germany, I was reading in the late 90s about how the government had said that, oh, it's all very well for us to have multiculturalism, but everybody must know that there is a leading culture in Germany. So, you know, there are such things. In England, you can see similar kinds of things. They have extremely agonizing debates about multiculturalism there as well. So my question, and by the way, here, if I do summarize, DN refers to developmental nationalism and CN to cultural nationalism. So how do they square with existing ahistorical classifications of nationalism? That was another question, because typically if you classify nationalisms, you get civic and ethnic and other such, which are supposed to apply across time and space. Whereas I didn't feel that this developmental cultural were such ahistorical categories. They were relevant to very determinate historical circumstances. Can you say that there are recognizable phases of developmental and cultural nationalism in the case of each country? I mean, prima facie evidence notwithstanding, what will you find if you systematically look at any old country? Also, and this is very key, because to me and to a lot of writers on India, you cannot understand Hindu nationalism without understanding the emergence of neoliberal political economy in India. Similarly, could you find such a connection in other countries as well? More generally, how have the national cultures and national political economies been linked? That was a connected question. What were the chief variations? How, when, why does the transition take place in each case, if it does at all? What are the differences? So these were some of the questions that one would have to ask if this idea was to have cross-contextual validity. You know, in English there is an expression, when you're talking about badly behaved kids, you say you can dress them up, but you can't take them out. So the point is that in this case, you know, I could put an entire theoretical edifice on the concept of my conceptions of developmental and cultural nationalism, but would they really work if taken out of the context of India? That was the question, right? So it had to have an appropriate theoretical address. This was my role, okay? And I tried basically in providing this to answer three questions. One is a very simple and basic question, which you can say should be a question for all scholarship on nationalism, but unfortunately, given its overwhelmingly cultural emphasis, tends not to be, which is that why does a universalizing capitalism produce particular nation states? How has this been understood and misunderstood over the centuries-long history of their emergence? And this is what I basically try to cover in the introduction to this volume. How have nations been understood hitherto? What has been the relationship between these understandings and the real revolution? Because as I started by saying, although nations have been evolving since the French Revolution or even since the American Revolution, we don't, and since the English Revolution, perhaps going back to the Dutch independence from Spain, however you think about it, it has been a very, very long process, initially slow, but then sort of gathering pace. But we haven't understood them in quite the significance that they now seem to have, at least to me, in the same way. As I say, there are points in history where people have simply stressed universal character of the new social order rather than its connection with specific nation states. And what is the range of agreement and disagreement in the cases? This is the task I take up in the conclusion. So, in trying to understand that first question, I began with a very important work that I feel has been quite universally praised, Tom Nairn's very early work dating back to 1978 and written in response to the emergence of nationalism in his native Scotland in the first instance, but then also attempting to understand what was happening more generally. And he, I think, makes a very, very important point. He says that nations are material, they are not just cultural, and this is how he understands it. He says that the origins of nations lie not in the folk, not in the individual's repressed passion for some sort of wholeness or identity, but in the machinery of world political economy. Not, however, in the process of that economy's development as such. Not simply as an inevitable concomitant of industrialization and urbanization, and here those of you who have studied nationalism will recognize that he's criticizing Gellner. So he says it's not just an accompaniment of industrialization, although Gellner's theorization is fairly powerful, it's sort of not sufficiently historical. So Nairn says it lies in the uneven development of history since the 18th century. This unevenness is a material fact. One could argue that it is the most grossly material fact about modern history. And I would add to that that, by the way, to this day, in fact today more than ever, your national belonging is a far more reliable predictor of your welfare than your class belonging. And I think that is a very important fact. In the last, five, six decades, I mean, when development was declared as a major objective of world policy, however hypocritically, the difference between the average GNPs of the advanced capitalist countries and the rest of the world was maybe three or four times. Today, depending on how you measure it, it can be as large as 24 times. This is shocking. right? So it is a very grossly material fact. The conclusion, he says, at once satisfying and near paradoxical, is that the most notoriously subjective and ideal of historical phenomena, because nationalism has, after all, given rise to the most airy-fairy romantic notions about what it is and what people are and so on. Most notoriously subjective and ideal of historical phenomena is in fact the byproduct of the most brutally and hopelessly material side of the history of the last few centuries. So I begin with such a conception. I go on more recently in a critique of the conventional realist account of international relations, Benno Teschke, in a book, very fine work called The Myth of 1648, in which he takes on this idea that modern international relations begins with the Treaty of Westphalia. I guess we are not in exactly Westphalia here, are we? Sort of next door or something. Anyhow, he says this was the 1648. It wasn't not that. He says that in fact it only began when the first modern capitalist nation came into being, and for him, and I'm sure this can be debated, but for him that was England. Anyway, but in the course of making this argument, he makes what for me a very fundamental argument, which sort of transfers man's account to a kind of international or geopolitical level. And here's where I'm asking you to recall that metaphor about the commodities being the cheap artillery that batters down Chinese walls. Because here, Teschke says, contrary to Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, the expansion of capitalism was not an economic process in which the transnationalizing forces of the market or civil society surreptitiously penetrated pre-capitalist states, driven by the logic of cheap commodities that eventually perfected a universal world market. It was a political and a fortiori a geopolitical process in which pre-capitalist state classes, that is, basically his conception is that once you got a capitalist state into being, what it did is it forced other state classes everywhere else to reorganize themselves and to create capitalist development from above in order to maintain their strength vis-a-vis the emerging economic and political strength of the capitalist core of the world system. So he said it is a geopolitical process in which pre-capitalist state classes had to design counter-strategies of reproduction to defend their position in an international environment which put them at an economic and coercive disadvantage. More often than not, it was heavy artillery, that is to say, real guns, not metaphorical guns, that battered down pre-capitalist walls. And the construction and reconstruction of these walls required new strategies of modernization. And what these ideas do is they put political economy at the center of understanding nationalism, nation states, and the evolution of a multinational world order, an international world order. However, the problem with Teschke is that he regards this is basically, for him, the process is still driven by pre-capitalist classes. So in a sense, the interaction of nations and capitalism has to do with the fact that there are pre-capitalist classes. This is a residue which will eventually go away. And he, in fact, even towards the end of his book, refers to the possibility of the creation of a world state. And I am not so sure about that. Because, in fact, in reality, nation states are as endemic as classes to capitalism, not an integument which capitalism will shed once it has become sufficiently advanced. And the reason for that are many. Two of them, very simply and sort of ahistorically, are, as Habermas points out, in although he's talking about a post-national constellation, but I particularly think this is very apt, that the territorial state, the nation, and the popular economy, because what the nation did is it gained the, socialists found out in 1914, it gained the adherence of its respective lower classes, working classes. So it constituted within national borders on the historical constellation in which the democratic process assumed a more or less convincing institutional form. The idea that one part of a democratic society is capable of reflexive intervention into society as a whole has until now been realized only in the context of nation states. So whether it is through a party, a working class movement, even a kind of Bismarckian state action, but whatever it is, some kind of social protection has only been achieved in the context of nation states. This refers, of course, directly to Karl Polanyi's important way of understanding the relationship between society and capitalist economy or market economy, where he says, he refers to the double movement, and I call it double-double, because in Canada, or double-double is a coffee that you can buy, with, I think, two sugars and two creams or something. But Polanyi calls it a double movement because he says market society spreads, and then society moves to protect itself against the ravages of the market. And I'm saying this is a double-double movement because that is happening at a domestic level, but at an international level, nations are in fact being created in the first place and strengthened and solidified in order to counteract the internationality of the market. Okay, so in that sense, it's a kind of, you may think about it as a double-double movement. And I'm really not sure that given the uneven development is a characteristic of capitalism, that this is going to ever, the need for this is ever going to end. And therefore the need for nations, I'm sorry to be sound provincial, I'm a cosmopolitan as much as the next person. But I think that that cosmopolitanism will only be realized through nations in a sense. So I'm referring here to one of the more relatively recent works on the developmental state, Alice Amsden's The Rise of the Rest, in which she points out that despite the dismal performance of most of the third world, in fact what you've seen are a substantial number of third world countries, which she then divides into two sets, who have successfully grown and industrialized despite the ravages of three decades of neoliberalism. And she divides them into the buying technology states and the making technology states. And just a small statistic, that in 1965, the rest provided 1/20th of world manufacturing. In 1995, it was 1/5. So it was a big change, and we are about to be, if you believe some interpretations of the present conjuncture in world history or the present financial crisis, we are poised before a further expansion of these states. And of course, if these states succeed, whether you may say, oh, that's only a few states, India, China, etc., they are of course populous, but even accepting that, the demonstration effect of that on other states is likely to be very powerful, because you are just coming out of three decades during which the less powerful states have been told that neoliberalism works, and they have had not much reason to believe otherwise. Now, they are not going to be told that, because I think neoliberalism is no longer standing on 2 feet anymore. And what's more, they will see who has succeeded out of all this. It's the states who were not outright neoliberal who have succeeded. So, anyway, so these are some. This is the way I conceive of the overall logic. How am I doing for time?
We're doing all right. We're going to have another 10 minutes.
Okay, I might take 15, if that's all right. Okay, so very quickly then, basically what it says on the tin is another expression. As I say, I like these expressions. So in English these days, it's very current to say, you know, if something is what it's supposed to be, you say it does what it says on the tin. So what does it say on my tin? What do I want you to judge this work by? Here are some things. So on my tin, I'm saying what we've tried to do, I've tried to do along with my colleagues, is create an original combination in the study of nationalism by combining cultural politics and political economy. Because we think that nations are not just about culture. And in doing so, we are combining with a very rich study of the cultures of nations, the equally rich but hitherto never combined study of comparative national political economy. You've got to do that in order to arrive at an overall understanding of nations. Also, a focus on historical change is original. In the sense, first of all, that they are not ahistorical categories, but also we feel that we have identified two historical forms, developmental and cultural, over the last 50, 60 years. And we may be poised before the beginning of a new one, which transcends that. If I'm right about neoliberalism, then I should be right about that, although I can't predict what it will be. And then before developmental nationalism, you could have another conception. Identify a reasonably demarkable historical field and say, what kind of nationalism did you have here? and what kind of nationalisms before then. And I think you could come up with some fairly interesting accounts. And again, one can talk about how that would be done. I've thought a little bit about it, but if any of you would like to talk, I would love that. Also, it introduces politics into nationalism, and one essay in particular in this volume by Spencer on Sri Lanka really shows how we think of conceptions of nations as somehow being above politics, but of course they are themselves deeply political, and they manage to shift politics about one way or another. And the essay on Sri Lanka shows that particularly well, I found. We focus on Asia because we happen to be Asianists, but quite frankly, we feel that it could and should be extended to other parts of the world. It will not be easy. The model will have to be adapted. I don't know how it would, for instance, adapt to Latin America. But I think that you could find similar changes under the impact of neoliberalism, which has, after all, been more or less an international phenomenon. When we first started out, the terms development and cultural nationalism were extremely problematic because people said, well, of course you always have development and you always have culture, so what is it, and so on. But in the end, the more I reflected on it, what we were referring to is the fact that all nationalisms have political economies and they have cultural politics. Yes, all nationalisms always have those two aspects. But in calling these nationalisms developmental nationalism and cultural nationalisms, we were actually using very apt terms. And here's why. Because development has a contemporary meaning. Developmental nationalisms were indeed very much connected with the ideas of development that became so powerful in the first few decades of the latter half of the 20th century, the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s, etc. And they were about very determinist things. It was about basically harnessing, either abolishing in the case of the communist countries, or harnessing in the case of developing countries, or restraining in the case of the welfare states, the capitalist system, the market economy, in some way, in order to produce wider, more popular levels of welfare. So in that sense, I think that remains valid. And in all sort of ways, the cultural nationalism which came in, and if you detect anti-postmodern tendencies here, you would be correct. Because the cultural term, which is often the way in which postmodernism is described, in a sense it purported to study culture, but at the same time, it cut away at the very thing that made the study of culture interesting, which was its relationship with material life. So in the postmodern study, in the 80s, 90s, and more recently, the postmodern study of culture actually pried cultural and material life apart. What was interesting about it then, I don't understand. They were no longer analyzed in relation with one another, and funnily enough, by attempting to replace material gain with cultural satisfaction, those who were the advocates of cultural nationalism were finally not doing the same thing. They were actually adopting a very postmodern notion of culture. Because after all, if you think about it, if you really wanted people to have culture and so on, you would offer them greater cultural competence, including most better schooling and better just material welfare, because you don't get culture without material welfare. Anyway, one can discuss that too, but I'm not trying to be overly schematic, but I am trying to insist that the relationship between culture and material life is the most important thing to investigate. If you want, you can criticize, say, Marxists or anybody else who attempts to, or anthropologists who attempt to come up with connection. You can criticize them for not doing a good enough job, but you can't say that was an illegitimate exercise. It is a very legitimate, and it's the only way the study of culture makes sense. So now just the last two slides, but I'll go back and forth to a lot of others, because now in these slides what I want to do is I want to show you with some of the richness of the collective project what we all, like, or what different contributions attempted and ended up highlighting about both developmental and cultural nationalisms. So, you know, people pointed, obviously, everybody basically agreed that there was a phase of a more egalitarian phase of nationalism which was developmental. And so, for instance, the essay on Iraq by Martin Bunton referred to something which everybody will recognize in some ways. It doesn't have to be about Iraq. He refers to state interventionist programs of independent governments which sponsored agrarian reform and import substitution industrialization for equitable distribution of national assets and incomes. At the same time, of course, this egalitarianism was undercut by the rightward undertone of the Cold War. So Laura Hine, in a contribution on Japan, which focuses on the particularly on the debate between the so-called Koza and Rono economists and what their contribution was to Japan's post-war society. She talks about how US officials tolerated and even subsidized Japanese developmental national institutions as an acceptable price for Cold War cooperation. But at the same time, they worked hard to marginalize the political stances that had originally justified them. So in a sense, they had to allow that, because that's how development even came into being, is that the US faced a world in which it had contended the Soviet Union on the one hand and nationalist aspirations on the other. How, if the Soviet Union was selling their communism, what was the US going to offer them? It was going to offer them capitalist development, which was somehow acceptable. Right, and the adjective capitalist was never used, but that's what it always meant. Development always meant capitalist development, but of a more acceptable sort. That was what was understood. It was, of course, internationalists, and most of you know this, so I'll just quickly go over this. Bandung was, of course, the great getting together of developmental nationalism. And what was really important is that leaders of the time genuinely believed that they were repudiating colonialism, and along with that, relations of dependency, racism, poverty, and so on. Remember that only a few decades before, the whole sloganeering about self-determination had been pushed because not enough Western leaders and leaders of powerful countries believed that third world countries were sufficiently qualified for independence. So this was a very, very big break, and I think that there was a great deal of solidarity around that. Sumit Salkar, in his very fine piece, and of course with a great historical sense, also referred to the fact that the leaders of various nationalist movements who were usually themselves from well-off classes, were also affected by a measure of elite guilt as very privileged people living among very poor people. Of course, how radical developmental nationalists were, because not all were equally radical, was connected with the fact that nationalisms had, these nationalisms rested on popular mobilization. So for example, in the case of Iraq, where high levels of inequality and exploitation under the monarchical government were the most important general cause of the wide support for the 58 revolution, the Qasim regime sought to achieve political and economic independence by destroying the basis of the traditional elite, which had perpetuated Western interests and compromised the country. So there was a very sense in which popular interests were national interests at that time. And this is what gave radicalism. By the way, this point is also made in very different ways by Ijaz Ahmed in a fine essay that he did on nationalism, and by Benedict Anderson, although I criticize him in that piece. His work on Southeast Asian societies is very fine, and in which he points out how tense was the equipoise between the left and the right, the Americans and the communists, and so on, in so many parts of Southeast Asia, which gave the police states at that time, in that area, their political character. Of course, popular mobilizations often brought very, very strong left-wing forces. So in Indonesia, Iraq, and many other places. And in Japan, again, I'm quoting Hine here, a small group of leftist Japanese technocrats, including several Rono economists, hurriedly produced a plan to rebuild the Japanese economy on a more egalitarian foundation. High wages, based on high wages, high labor productivity, peace-based economy, none of which you could find in Japan. And where there was no mobilization and no left, there was really very little developmental nationalism. And this comes up particularly in Sri Lanka, where Sensei underlined the extent to which there was no mass anti-colonial nationalist movement, and fateful patterns of vertical political mobilization within ethnic communities ensured that the official imagery of development has, from the 30s at least, been steeped in the symbolism of a more narrow culturally defined nationalism. Of course, the economic contradiction at the heart of developmental nationalism was that rather than egalitarian prosperity and political empowerment of lower and working classes, the limited radicalism of developmental nationalism simply ended up expanding the property that middle classes. New groups were often added, and of course the addition of new groups to the property classes is a very critical part of my analysis of Hindutva in India. Developmental nationalisms were also critical of inherited cultures, and this is often something we forget. We assume that nationalisms celebrate inherited cultures, but they didn't always. China was paradigmatic. The spectacular failure of traditional society and polity against imperialism meant anti-traditionalism dominated, and most intellectuals believed that the Chinese national character had so many serious shortcomings that cultural and spiritual restructuring programs were urgently needed to cure, and even for some to remake the nation. And in the Middle East, in a very fine essay, Mohammed Barnier, which has really interesting tensions with the larger project, he points out that in the Middle East, even religions were reoriented to secular nationalism. He says, where the question was, which is the most effective vehicle against colonialism, Islamic currents became aspects of nationalism, and secular authorities maintained some vague sense of a common nationalist agenda with Muslim political organizations, repressing them only when they appeared to pose a challenge to secular state power, as in Egypt under Nasser. And the cultural contradiction, of course, is that there was a cultural conservatism in many ways persists. You can see that. I mean, and there are various examples here. But in the Indian case, for example, although I emphasize the extent to which the earliest nationalism was economic, you still find profoundly conservative conceptions of the nation, even in the writings of people like Ramesh Chandradas or him. They end up appealing to cultural concepts of India, which remain quite problematic. So that was developmental nationalism. Then my last set of remarks on cultural nationalism. Cultural nationalism, I connect first and foremost to neoliberalism. And I insist on several things. And this is probably going to be something else I will write about, because I feel this is a good moment to write about it, because I feel that neoliberalism has, in a sense, self-destructive. So it's a good time to reflect on it. Hegel says the owl of Minerva takes flight in dusk. Neoliberalism was not a doctrine. It was a particular politics. And if you try to find out who implemented neoliberalism purely, you will not find anything. In reality, neoliberalism did not push back the state. If you look at the state's share in expenditures, they have simply remained the same or even gone up marginally. It was accompanied by both growth and decline, depending on which country you were looking at. But it was always accompanied by inequality, greater inequality, expanding the possessing classes, increasing their insecurity, in fact, even their political vertigo, in a sense, because, you know, if you're up there and lots of people are still very poor, what is the overall sense that creates? And it also emerges out of the cultural out of the economic contradictions of developmentalism, welfareism, communism, etc. Either gradually, very slowly, as in the case of India, or violently, as in the emblematic case of Indonesia. Cultural nationalism does not just encompass extreme nationalist politics, and this is something that I insist upon very much, because you can't understand Hindutva in India if you only focus on the Bajrang Dal. And people try to say, well, you know, they have, you know, this core program of Hindutva, and maybe, you know, the BJP has given it up. But the BJP the core program is only there as a stick to wave now and then. But there is a wider, more widely accepted, quieter politics, which is still extremely pernicious, which the BJP is conducting, and we have to try to understand that. And it is an agenda of both economic and cultural inequality. And of course, the Congress and so-called center and left parties also accept it. Let me just quickly say here that neoliberalism, by the way, you might say that does neoliberalism apply everywhere? But you even find in the Iranian case, which in every other way is such an exception, that there is in fact a clearly identifiable phase which begins roughly with the end of the war with Iraq, where you have the Iranian revolutionary Islamic state promoting a form of capitalism, which is actually creating new possessing classes, new forms of corruption, etc., etc. So definitely that's part of the story. In the Chinese case, you'd say, what do you mean neoliberalism? But of course, China moves towards a more market-oriented model at a certain phase. And by the way, the Anagnost piece is really interesting because it just shows the extent to which in China, just an unequal political economy without having very much to do with cultural things like Confucianism is actually generating a new, more commodified culture, which forms nevertheless the basis of a new cultural nationalism in China. In Indonesia's so-called proyek, which became a very, which became one of the few ways the regime had in an extremely fractured cultural context of creating legitimacy, when you did not have developmental means of creating legitimacy. So these were all variations on the theme of neoliberalism. In the case of Japan, which would be another perhaps limit case, Hein points out that although in the Japanese case, the developmental model remains strong, nevertheless, the fact that it had created a larger middle class and so on tended to create this kind of Nihonjin Ron Japan is unique feeling as a backlash against those who had recently won rights. And so, in cultural terms, I would say there are two principal cultural dynamics of cultural nationalism. One is to re-articulate the national culture to include new entrants within the ruling classes, and we have shown them in a number of different ways, and sometimes it may even take multicultural forms. And secondly, to manage the have-nots, which are inevitably the result of a neoliberal political economy, without giving material concessions, to manage them culturally by articulating inequality as cultural difference. There are a few postmodern variants, but I won't go into that. We can talk about it, and maybe I'll come back to it in the Q&A. So that was the result of the project. This book is about to be published, and it's called Developmental and Cultural Nationalisms. And this is one of the postmodern variants. This picture is actually taken from a rally opposing the Prime Ministership of Thaksin Shinawatra in Thailand. And Tongchai Winichakul in the book, he actually presents an analysis which more or less predicted that this would happen, this close alliance between royal nationalism in Thailand and these anti-democratic forces. So, thank you.
I'm grateful to leave. Yeah, anyone else wants to leave? Now is the time. Okay. The culture and tradition of this colloquium is that you get an applause twice. First, after you've spoken, and next, at the end of the conversation. I think I have to be honest about it. I've been around for 14 years, and I think you should hold the record for bringing in references to people we have not read. And that's how it should be. We get too bogged down in the South Asian Institute to try and understand South Asia in terms of South Asia. You have reminded us there's a much bigger world out there. Well done. This is the kind of paper I would like to sit down and read. And this is what I would like to. There's the witness I'm inviting you to present your paper to our series. And I'm inviting all of you to consider our series. It's called Heidelberg Papers in South Asian and Comparative Politics. All you have to do is to Google Heidelberg Papers. You'll get the rules of submission. And I've already lined up a distinguished historian as your anonymous referee. That's what it's about.
Anonymous.
Only Germany, one can have that kind of confidence, because only Germany allows us to nurture our promising talents as doctoral candidates and then examine them. It's done all the time. It's called parenting. Those of you who have had the joy of parenting should know that the doctor father can be both nurturing and sterile. that is the subjectivity and the objectivity of intellect. Remember, you are lecturing at the university where Hegel was a student. I don't see much of Hindutva, which is in your title, but not in the lecture itself, except you have sneaked in, tucked in towards the end. Hindutva as a quieter, wider, pernicious politics. We would like to hear a little more about it. I would. As developmental nationalism goes, except Modi's last campaign, I have not seen much of it as a legitimizing device in Indian politics. Modi, that was the excellent India Today take on him, did present himself as a developmental nationalist, not a cultural nationalist. Gujarat Incorporated was what it was about. So I eagerly look forward to the book to understand if developmental nationalism has, as you said, legs to stand on. Because if it did, it would really combine the best of nationalism, which is ask me not what you can do for me, ask me what I can do for you. Because that's what nationalism is about. It's about killing and dying, and death is the end of all felicity. And yet, cultural nationalism has a field day. If you read for culture religion, then every serial bomb blast in India is a flag being waved for cultural nationalism. And it works. And at the same time, if we could add to that excitement, that self-giving politics, the comfort of respect for difference, and add to it a higher rate of growth, then we would have a creature to cherish for. Does it work? Is it there? I don't know. What I've learned from you today, and I'll happily take away, is the role of politics in it all. By politics, I understand choice. That Anderson doesn't. Anderson does not give political choice to an idea. It comes across sometimes as teleological, sometimes as autonomous and necessary. The reason I'm talking about it is because in the 90s, I struggled with it myself. There is a piece in the British Journal of Political Science called Rational Politics of Cultural Nationalism. In that piece, I tried to combine exactly what you're suggesting should. Six hypotheses, three drawn on the material basis of elites wanting, regional elites wanting for their people what others have already got. And three hypotheses talking about why one should be ready to kill or die for what believes in, what one believes in. And now that I've heard the talk, I'll send it off to you. Anyway, those of you who have seen my culture and nationality might have seen that article. But I have not seen it in such an elegantly argued out form, with so many references, which I'd like to be 10 years younger to read again and rework. But then if you have your paper, I'll save myself that trouble. The rule and culture and tradition of this colloquium is that we have a general conversation. It's not a firing squad. It's a conversation of all of us, you included. So if you feel that you have not a question but a comment, but a comment and a comment, you must assume that there is a round table, there is a head of table, that in this round table, every link in the chain is important. If you want to do that, all you have to do is raise your hand and I'll recognize you. But if you think you have got a supplementary question or a comment, you can jump in and you get precedence. For that, you show two fingers. So one finger for a question, two fingers for a supplementary question or a comment. I'll stop now and open the general conversation. Who'd like the floor? Have I seen a hand going up there from Singapore? No, not yet.
Well, yeah, okay. I was wondering how strong for you the link is between neoliberal politics and the rise of cultural nationalism. Do neoliberal politics, in a way, always produce some form of cultural nationalism? What kind of intensity do they produce, and how do you see now, since you mentioned you think that the neoliberal order at least will have to struggle the next years, what does that mean for cultural nationalism in the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, and this partly addresses some of the things that Mr. Mitra raised as well, I must underline that I see cultural nationalism as a historical category. And in a sense, so is neoliberalism, because neoliberalism, as the way I understand it, it's not a doctrine which can turn up at any time in history. It's a very determinate politics, which emerged at a very determinate moment when its task was to roll back the state's developmentalist, welfarist, and even ultimately communist functions. Communist, I put in quotation marks, but you know what I'm trying to say. And it did that without reversing the historical increase in the state involvements in the economy. So it was not what it said it was. It wasn't what it said on the tin. It was something different. And it was a particular type of politics of preserving and even extending to some extent the political and other privileges of the possessing classes. And everywhere, neoliberalism has been accompanied by growing inequalities. The reason why, so that is a so I don't think you can use the term. I think if somebody once again, say 30 years, 40 years down the road, once again starts talking about free markets, it would be a very different context, and it should ideally have another name. And the reason why this was called neoliberalism is because everybody was aware that in the so-called what Hobsbawm calls the 30-year crisis from 1914 to 1945, liberal capitalism died. You can't have the rebirth of liberal capitalism. That would be historically anachronistic. A lot of water has flowed under the bridge. So what you got was a group of people waving the banner of free markets, but not to actually achieve free markets. I don't think that was their intention anyway. I mean, except for some people who are extremely doctrinaire, and in fact I wrote about them, some of them. One of my earliest works was an article on neoliberal think tanks in the UK, and there one met all kinds of very charming ideologues who very naively believed in what they said. But of course, on the whole, neoliberalism was about opening up financial markets in particular, and about decreasing the welfare functions of the state. So what it ended up doing is it created a more unequal society. And that unequal society, what I feel cultural nationalism primarily did, was it provided a way of articulating inequality as cultural difference. Okay. And so what he did was, so when people look at Hindutva, for example, in India, sorry I did not include, I was trying to sort of put Hindutva in a much broader context, but when people look at Hindutva in India, they think that Hindutva is only about Muslims and other minorities. And of course, it is one of the most murderous aspects of Hindutva, and I would be the last person to say that's not important. But look also at what else it's doing. It's doing at least two other things. Firstly, it is ordering the so-called Hindu community from within, it's reordering it. So for example, if you hold certain types of views, if you are, for example, a feminist who likes to stand up, you would be called a Western or inspired, whatever, you know, etc. Or if you, so that's another, so it reorders the internal community. And also, it puts Brahmanical values at the core. Although Hindutva claims to be against caste, what it does is it puts Brahmanical values, ways of life, at the core. So everybody who cannot or does not participate in that is somehow lesser. Okay? And I shouldn't even say Brahmanical, a mix of Brahmanical and Western. Okay? Now, that's what it does. The other thing that it does is it actually also works on, I mean, while it of course victimizes Muslims, it is not necessarily saying What it's trying to do is it's trying to keep them in their place. And this is not just done by victimizing them, but also enticing them positively, positively quotation mark, to behave in ways that are acceptable to him. So you create a good Muslim, bad Muslim dialectic. So you know, I've interviewed Advani. He says, why can't the Muslims be like the folks in Indonesia who value Hindu culture? I mean, sorry, the context is completely different, right? So that's my point. So I think that cultural nationalism has tended to do that everywhere. And that's not the other reason. Another reason why Hindu should not be seen as monolithic or homogenizing, as a lot of people try to do, and which I find in another part of my analysis of Hindutva, I also examine the relationship between Hinduism and Hindutva. And the two are usually contrasted. They are supposed to be opposites, but actually they are very closely connected to each other, historically and in contemporary times. And so Hindutva also takes multicultural forms. Hindutva likes to say India is secular because it is Hindu. It's not just 1984 double speed. I mean, there is a sense in which there is a relationship. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but and just in connection, because it's about neoliberalism, I mean, Modi. I mean, that's the kind of difference I we are trying to articulate between saying that every nationalism has a political economy, and the fact that Modi emphasizes the political economy of his nationalism in a given election it does not escape the theoretical structure we have built. But what it is a political economy of neoliberalism. It is a political economy of unbridled capitalist development in Gujarat, combined with both state and non-state forms of labor repression. And I underline state and non-state because one of the things you find when you analyze Gujarat, which of course is an extremely depressing thing to have to do, but it needs to be done, is that the extent to which the repression of working people and poor people of all sorts is undertaken not just by state forces, but by forces that are supported by the state. I mean, Godhra was only the most horrific example of that, in which the state participated in a pogrom, effectively, against a section of its own population, right? So, I think that in that sense, I think that, the fact that Modi has a political economy, but it's a neoliberal political economy, that's what I mean.
Professor Adam, I have a question which follows up on your Modi to bring back Hindutva into this perspective. You say neoliberal. Would this be an explanation for the rather puzzling fact that Hindutva has become so terribly strong exactly in Gujarat, which didn't invent it? The Maharashtrians next door invented the whole doctrine, but the Gujaratis have exemplary practice this whole thing. So would this be the confirmation of your equation, neoliberalism, cultural naturalism, nationalism of the Hindutva type? And could you then explain also the pogroms and all this under this rubric of neoliberalism?
It's in a sense connected to my earlier question and also to this question about Gujarat. I mean, this relationship between inequalities and maybe also the strength of cultural nationalisms. What I always found interesting with regard to India is the uneven spread of Hindutva. And one thing that particularly puzzled me is that if you take the state that I'm most familiar with, which is Tamil Nadu, where Hindutva has had up to now very little success in mobilizing people. And I mean, conversing with people, it is certainly not because people in Tamil Nadu would be immune to the doctrine of Hindutva. Certainly not. You could certainly come up with a great, and this whole idea of glorious Hindu culture or whatsoever, you could certainly lure people with that. I've always wondered why it has had so little success in Tamil Nadu. And on the other hand, you have very great success in states like Gujarat, and I've always kind of found it sad that there's a tendency to study success stories. There's much less tendency of studying failed stories or as yet failed stories.
I have two pieces in which I explore this, because I exactly, but I started, well, let me take two steps back. First of all, being from Gujarat, I cannot fail but to be engaged with the issue of why the Hindutva is strong in Gujarat. But once I started thinking about it, and I have written about it, and I'd be happy to send you the pieces, I said, well, but what is the geography of Hindutva's differential advance around the country? What explains the fact that it is advanced, it is relatively stronger? It is basically the hegemonic force. I mean, it is so hegemonic in Gujarat, it's, I mean, it's beyond depressing. Because there is, what does Congress do? In the last election, what did Congress do? It got an RSS man to lead it. I mean, it is, you cannot find any higher level of disorganization of opposing political forces. It is horrific. But at the same time, and of course, Godhra, I mean, let me, first of all, I leave the analysis of, rephrase that. I think Godhra is, of course, horrific. But in order to understand Godhra, you have to understand things that are more taken for granted, regarded as much less horrific. Because, quite frankly, beyond the point, I can't read about Godhra was so horrific that you know that. And also, you may have all kinds of extremely fancy theorizations of violence and so on, which I don't do. What I'm trying to give you is, I'm trying to give you an explanation of why it happens in Gujarat. The long and short of it is that, as far as the Godhra happened for two reasons. One is Hindutva strength in Gujarat, which I will explain in a minute, but just for the moment take that for granted. Combined with the fact that it was in power, Godhra could not have happened if there was no Hindutva government, both at the center and in the state government. Okay, this is very, very important. Second, so now then let's take a step back. What explains the differential advance? And here is where the political economy and the cultural politics really meet. Because my explanation of Hindutva and is very deeply connected with neoliberalism, and it goes roughly as follows. And I wish it's not my computer, because I would have shown you the charts that I have made, because I basically analyzed the electoral record, both for Gujarat as well as at an all India level. And I have the charts to show it. What you have basically in India, this will take a few minutes, so if you don't mind. Yeah, but.
We have 7 o'clock in India.
Okay.
Oh,
what we have basically in India is a situation in which, for the first couple of decades after independence, the state attempted to pursue a developmentalist strategy, but ultimately, and it achieved a lot of things, but ultimately it could not achieve it could not put in place the keystone of that strategy. What was that keystone? That keystone had nothing to do with industrialization, which is the thing that everybody tries to pin on Nehru. The eventual result would have been a more sustainable pattern of industrialization, but what it failed to achieve was to promote an agrarian transformation on the basis of an egalitarian strategy. When that failed, it left the entire Indian countryside, which means the vast bulk of its population, to a more or less market-driven strategy. Now, when I was at a panel organized by various people at kind of LSE Columbia workshop, where I presented my argument of the explanation of Hindutva, and people say, what do you mean market-driven, because the state continues to intervene? Yes, but it does so in the interest of those who already have substantial land. Okay, so it is more or less market-driven strategy. So the fate of Indian agriculture since the late 60s, since the planned holidays, has been left to a more or less market-driven strategy. What has that done? It has given rise to an extremely inegalitarian pattern of development in the countryside. And I emphasize this also because when you read books about India that, or even explanations of Hindutva that only focus on the urban sector, they're completely losing it. Because elections in India are still won and lost in the countryside. If you can only explain why the urban middle classes love Hindutva, well, that's rather obvious, quite frankly. It doesn't need an explanation. You've got to explain the other stuff. Okay, so now what happens is that there are these folks, I was telling Professor Mitra about this. Now you introduce what I call a caste class analysis into Hindutva. Basically, you have a development which has not been anticipated by any of the literature, except I think my writing and maybe one or two others, but I can't think at the moment. But basically, the in India what you have are these so-called dominant caste peasantry, which in the south have always been basically the sort of lords of the land on the whole. And in the north, after the weak land reform we had, basically it ended up empowering them, right? So these folks are the ones who, at least the property section among the middle caste peasantry, become capitalist farmers, and over time many of them even become successful bourgeoisie without qualification. They start investing in the urban sector. Right? It is these folks who are the biggest single group of new entrants into the Indian property classes. Hindutva is about articulating their new unity with the previously existing property ruling classes, who are predominantly high caste. These folks are not low caste, and that's another mistake most Indians make. They, you know, since most Indian intellectuals are high caste, I like to make this joke. They think everybody who is not high caste is low caste. No, India has a thick middle of middle castes. They are by far the most numerous section of the Indian population. Of course, things are not made any better by the fact that we call them other backward classes. There are all these very, and whatever, they're very confusing terminologies, which confuses Indians more than anybody else, quite frankly. Because I don't think they understand the dynamics, understand the dynamics of their own society. Anyway, so these middle castes, who have in recent history been leaders of anti-Brahmin movements in some parts of the country and so on. But also historically, they are the ones whose domination has also been legitimized by the very same Brahmins when they needed it, right? You get a few, you know, it's a bit like, you know, Jats have very healthy attitude towards Brahmins. You call them in when you need them to perform a bit of mumbo jumbo, and you then pay them and let them go, right? Okay, anyway, that's jokes apart. Basically, these groups have become the new entrance into the ruling class. Hindutva articulates their identity. And where we get it wrong is, for example, in all the literature to this day, Mandal politics and Mandal politics is opposed to each other. The politics of the reservations for the other backward caste and the politics of Hindutva. They are not opposed to each other. Okay, they are very much connected. And how they are connected and what it has to do with Gujarat is this. Basically, there has been a huge change in the Indian political landscape over the last 30 odd years, since the historic election of 1967. That was the first time when you really witnessed the political assertion of these middle caste groups. Over time, they have settled down into three major trends, all of which are interconnected. One is the long decline of the Congress Party. So that from ruling the country, it now cannot rule without the support of a number of other people. I don't think it's ever going to go back to its former dominance. And this decline has been caused by the exit of these groups. Of course, they have exited, they have come back, and they have exited again, but the long-term trend has been to exit. Second, the rise of Hindutva. Okay, and the third is the rise of regional parties. Now, the exit of these middle class groups initially took a form of farmers' movements and so on, but eventually settled down into being what I call the parties of the provincial property classes, otherwise known as regional bourgeoisie. Now, in some states, you had very strong parties of the provincial property classes. Let's take Andhra Pradesh as a paradigmatic example. In these states, however, the strongest section of these parties allies with Hindutva. This is very key, and habitually with, okay? And just now I'm getting down to the geography. However, in other states, and Gujarat is a paradigmatic example, these folks have basically joined BJP. There is no regional party. And Congress is left with the support of those lower down the social scale, okay? And Congress is unwilling to accept that at a national level. This is Congress's problem, but we won't. So basically now, so in this paper in which I'll talk about the geography of Hindutva for this workshop that I did, and it's coming out in a volume, but basically I think there are, I wish I had my computer, but anyway, I think that there are two or three or four or five separate patterns, okay. The first is states in which you have a straight BJP-Congress contest, in which middle class groups have on the whole joined the BJP directly. They have basically joined the Congress. Second are states in which you have very strong regional parties, only one. So Orissa, Andhra Pradesh, they typically align with BJP. Partly because they hate Congress. Congress has been so patronizing to them that they really dislike Congress. Thirdly, you have states like Tamil Nadu is a paradigmatic example where the entire party system is totally regional. In which case, one major party allies with BJP, other major party allies with Hindu. And they, in Tamil Nadu, of course, being Tamils, you know, they shift around quite a lot. And then you have a fourth pattern in which, like Maharashtra, I think is a distinct fourth pattern, because in there you have NCP and Shiv Sena are very similar in social composition. And then they are, so NCP joined with Congress, who will support lower down the social scale, and Shiv Sena joins with BJP, who will support further up the social scale. So you have this, so basically what you're looking at is the working out in very complex caste class terms of a polarization of Indian society. But it is rooted in the countryside. Of course, the city was always polarized, but it is, this is in the countryside, and this is my explanation. So in Gujarat, why is BJP so strong in Gujarat? Because, and there's one more element in Gujarat. So it is unbridled, I mean, Gujarat is, in one of the things I wrote, I called Gujarat the Hindutva of development. If you, there's one more factor, and this is what separates Gujarat from UP. Both in Gujarat and UP, you have roughly the same proportion of high caste as a proportion of the population. They are relatively higher than in most other Indian states. This has nothing to do with them being nicer or better or anything, it just happens with the historical peculiarity. However, in UP, UP is a land of underdevelopment on the whole, except for some of its western parts. In UP, because ritual distance is underlined by economic distance, because the middle and lower castes remain that much less well off than the upper castes, you can't bring them together easily. In Gujarat, historically this has been the pattern, by the way. Middle caste groups have periodically risen and joined the elites. Today, you know, 100 years ago, Patels were still considered only middle caste. Today, no member of polite Gujarati society can disdain a Patel. They can't. And they, you know, I mean, I'm not in favor of capitalism, but nor am I in favor of discrimination. Do you know? And I think more power to them. They have basically forced their way into the Gujarati elites. And successfully. Similarly, new groups are coming up. And because Gujarat is relatively more economically dynamic, these groups are able to rub shoulders economically with the previously existing elite, which then nullifies the significance of ritual distance, for what it's worth. So that's my explanation of Gujarat.
Are there other questions? Maybe from my colloquium, maybe from people who are looking at cultural experience. That's you, Jonathan.
Just a quick question. Since you have a link cultural nationalism to Hindutva, I wonder whether cultural nationalism is always violent or whether there are more peaceful utterances of cultural nationalism.
I would say just look at Hindutva, it has both in it. You know, in many countries you can have extreme right groups that are not formally part of the same organization. It just so happens that in India, although it is a kind of, you know, I mean, BJP probably also has its hooligans, but on the whole the hooligans belong to the Bajrangdal and the Shiv Sena and so on. So there is a bit of an organizational division there too, but we all know they belong to the same family of organizations. But I would say that the extent to which force is used and you know, the kind of civil society type of force is used against marginalized groups will be specific. I mean, India comes to it with its own history of communalism and so on, which, by the way, has also increased since that same conjuncture of the late 60s. There has been a marked increase in communal incidences and events. And so And so this goes along with the whole issue of, you know, the giving up of developmentalism and so on. So my answer, my straight answer to your question is they don't have. I mean, what the peculiar thing here is not other countries, but Hindutva. Hindutva is peculiar in the sense that it clearly unites these extremist wing as well as this sort of, you know, Atal Bihari Vajpayee of this world, who is generally taken for a great statesman, but he is the one who belongs to the party that nurtures these folks. At the end of the day, he's an RSS man. He goes to those strange rituals and shakas, and so we forget that. And I'm astonished at how easily people forget that that's where he comes from, you know.
My name on the list too, and I was saving myself for the last. Is it possible to think of Gandhi and Ambedkar as cultural nationalists?
Because no, that would be anachronistic. That would be anachronistic. That is to say that there is a sense in which Gandhi, I would say, is a very conservative person. I don't think that Gandhi was a very radical leader at all. In fact, he did everything in his power to make sure that radical currents were contained, shall we say, in Indian nationalism. So Gandhi would be, for me, a conservative figure, although he also, because he lived in the time that he did, he recognized the importance of addressing poverty in India. And that is important. Even a conservative like him had to do that. Ambedkar is a completely different figure. I would not put the two in the same category. I mean, I think that Ambedkar's story is a great tragedy of Indian history. I think it should be seen as such, that he attempted to achieve something which in so many ways was so completely understandable, rational, etc., but he was always prevented from doing so, you know, including by Gandhi. And by other right-wing Congress, you know, Jiva was telling me she's working on party on the Hindu Code Bill controversy, and you know, in that, I mean, Ambedkar, in a sense, there is a kind of almost poetic justice, at least in his ambition. He wanted to be the modern Bhagavan. He wanted to be the new lawgiver of India, saying that we are going to get rid of all these strange, I mean, it would have been a very progressive thing for women in India too, had he succeeded on the whole. I mean, less, I'm sure you know more about the details of his program, but from what I know. This was not possible in that time, and this is partly, as I said, what was the cultural contradiction of development to nationalism, what the extent to which conservatism persisted, and that was part of it, and a large part of it was Gandhi's doing.
I have to bring it to a close, because normally we have 2-hour sessions, so I'm sure, of course, that part of the six, I would like to thank the audience for the patience and forbearance, and I would like to thank you, Radhika, for very engaging and provocative lecture. In case you didn't know, Radhika actually comes from Gujarat. I have to take very, very seriously the things you have said about Gujarat and about the rest of India, particularly like the regional comparison. So that, did you say, does the talk have legs? I think you have plenty.
Thank you
very much. Join me.